K4BJL, KB0, KBJ. Good evening.
Good evening, Toyo. Can you repeat this last week for me again?
Hey, yeah. Name here is Steve. How you doing?
I'm out of Hendersonville, North Carolina. What's your QTH?
I'm coming to you through the echo link here on the repeater. It seems a little flaky. I don't know. It keeps popping up and down. If you said your name, I didn't get it. Name here is Steve. Heard you're in Hendersonville. We're up here in South Dakota. No, eastern, northeastern South Dakota, they're over.
Well, you're sounding great. Yeah, Steve, I caught your name was. My name is Russell. And yeah, that's correct. I'm out of Hendersonville, North Carolina on my 50-watt mobile unit. Hopefully it's coming through a little bit more clearly now that it's warmed up a little bit. But I'm surprised that you're coming through as clear as you are on Echolink. Sometimes when I try to use Echolink, I feel like I'm coming in really muddled. I'm not really sure how to modify Echolink.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's got this radio here. It looks like it's nothing up there without overstay. It does. We'll go with that anyhow. Yeah, you're sounding good onto the repeater also. Well, nice evening up this way. Had a bit of a breeze today, as I think it's been most last few days. Kind of just a stiff, 15-20 mile an hour wind all day. Today I was out of the northeast. Yesterday I was out of the, which way was it? It was out of the, I think the day before that it was out of the south. So just blowing the ball, sunny every day. at least it was a little cooler today. Been getting kind of warm up here. Too warm for this time of year, that's for sure. I think it was, somewhere in the 60s only today, so that's nice. Yeah, I think it was yesterday at 82. So for the beginning of May, a bit warm. Wish we had spring to hang out a little longer, you know. But it doesn't seem to do that anymore. It just goes from wham, winter to spring in about a month, or winter to summer in about a month. And we're supposed to be getting up there in 80s this weekend also, and 80s early next week before dropping back into the 70s. So that's the wacky weather we got up here in the high plains. Went swimming yesterday. My kids did. I did too, I guess. Waded around a little bit in the local lake. Fish were kind of spawning there near the shore. Carp. Stirring the water up. You can see a fin rise above the water now and then. So I grabbed my spear gun and I just took a blind shot where I seen some water roiling around. I got one. Oh yeah, I got one, man. Pull it in. It's actually two of them. Shot two fish in one shot. How's that happening? They're pretty rare, especially when you don't even see them, you know. That was kind of fun. They're a junk fish, but anyhow, they're big. Back to you there, Russell. K4BJL, KB0, KBJ.
Sorry, you said that you shot the fish. What kind of fish were those again?
No, oh, I don't know. Carp. Yeah, carp, Asian carp, or nah, I don't know what. Anyhow, big carp. Probably about 10-pound fish each, two of them.
Much about the weather in South Dakota, but I certainly would imagine that 80s in May would probably be highly atypical, or I would imagine it would be a lot colder. It's certainly still pretty springtime around here, I think. Cold in the mornings, like 40s and stuff. Enough to be able to get the plants and stuff like that outside. And you have loads of birds. It's amazing. I was sitting out this morning with my coffee around 6 or 7 or so. And I mean, it's just like, I took a video of it and sent it to my family because it's like almost hard to sit outside just because of how loud all the songbirds are, which is kind of a cool feeling. But it's like there's some kind of big argument that they're all having, which is kind of funny, but loads of bluebirds and robins and lots of other birds that I haven't been real good about learning about, but it's been fun kind of sitting out there trying to notice patterns, where they all are, and I've enjoyed that more this season than I've really taken note of it in previous seasons. Just seeing all the birds come back in the spring has been really enjoyable, and nesting around our house and stuff. I got a robin just outside my garage underneath my little carport, which is pretty neat, and then I've got a dove that settled in a planter's little pot that was hanging up. I was getting ready to repurpose the soil, and a dove was just hanging out, and had already used it as a nest, so I figured it was making good use of the soil, so leaving the dove to themselves. But I've also been enjoying a lot of the springtime weather. It's been really nice getting to be outside. I think I got your call sign with KB0 KBJ. Confirm. This is KR4BJL.
Okay, I gotta add a heart to your call there. We'll do that. At least try to. Yeah, Kilo Bravo Zero. Kilo Bravo Japan. You got that right. If that's what you got down. If you don't, well, make it so. Yeah, good to see spring come along. I guess I don't even call in the robins as that. Robins seem to be the first. Oh, I remember when it is. Robins always come back. It seems a little too early, but they're the first bird. Maybe because they get it so close to you, you know. But robin's first sign of spring. And you see a robin coming, oh, yes. But, you know, they're rather a big bird. I mean, they're not a goose. You see them flying around. Pelicans, see them flying around here, too. Eagles, even vultures. But, I mean, you know, ones that come hopping up to you on the lawn. Most other birds fly away, a robin doesn't. So maybe that's why you notice them. But anyhow, I remember when they came, it was about a week before, it was about the last week of March or so, I think. Maybe it was 2 weeks. Maybe it was somewhere mid-March. We've seen our first robin up here. Was it March? Yeah, March. And early, and then they get snow down. We had snow at the very beginning of April, April 1st. And so there they are out there shivering in the snow, freezing their toes off, you know. Not that happens to their toes, but it always makes me wonder when you see them out there in the snow. I was like, I wonder if they, I don't suppose they do. They got nothing but a bird brain, but if they, makes you wonder if they would just be like, I wonder why I always come so early. It's cold here again. Timed it wrong. But anyhow, that's when the robins came this year. It was about the last week, I'd say, or so of March. And the ice went off of the lakes. Oh, man, did that go off fast. It was somewhere in February. I mean, it was just, beginning or middle of February, the ice just melted off the lakes like within the 2 weeks. It went from 18 inches thick to just open water in about 2 weeks, which is, phew, wow. Because everybody had their ice shacks out on the lake. Let me let it break here so I don't time out the repeater. Yeah, everyone was out there, ice houses on the lake, you know. We're talking like campers, you know. Special made campers, you can lower down to the ice, you got all there driving out there and everything and just doing the ice fishing and all about that, and all of a sudden, boom, the temperature shot up to about 50 degrees, it seemed like, when all the ice shacks are just gone. There's been a town out on the local lakes, some spots. There were a town of ice shacks, and all of a sudden they're gone, every one of them, and people aren't daring to drive out or anything. It was a good reason this year. It just melted so incredibly fast. So, yeah, that's kind of how winter went. A few of the highlights, at least this latter half of winter. It's like right now, we only see leaves starting to come on the trees. Like, well, now is when you're starting to see it. They're not fully on all the way yet. I still could look out the window here as the sun sets. And yeah, this tree across the street from me, it's, I can see the start of leaves on it against the skyline there, but it's not full leaves by any means. I'd say give it another 2 weeks or maybe a week and we're going to have full leaves, depending on the species of trees, you know. So that's kind of where we're at there, Russell. Back to you.
See you catch it whenever you're doing the ice fishing.
I don't know. Did we double or what? All I said heard was you say something about fishing. Coming through fine. There's a bit of a whine in there. It's nothing to do with your signal, though. I think it's somewhere in between. Once again, ask me that again. You're asking a question about the fishing. Say again, what's the question again?
What type of fish do you find when you go fishing? What kind of fish?
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's just same as in the summer. Summer, winter, they're all about the walleye up here. You gotta have the walleye fever. They stock the lakes around here, you know. The local, well, the DNR, state DNR, they stock the lakes, and I suppose they throw in some other, you know, bass and such, but, mostly walleye. They don't stock with northern pike. There's plenty of them out there. That I guess you don't have to stock them with northern because they just reproduce them. They're a good fish to eat. They're just kind of slimy and kind of like an alligator, you know. But you get over that, the meat's actually good stuff. So, mostly walleye to answer your question, over.
Cool, that sounds like that'd be a lot of fun. I don't know much about ice fishing. I know around here in West North Carolina, people do a lot of fly fishing and trout fishing, that's for sure. Especially around some of the state parks around here, which has been good to get back to. People are taking a lot of breaks after the hurricane, but I have a lot of friends who have been getting back out there and catching some trout again, which has been good. I try to spend enough time outside. Would like to explore more about fishing. Yeah, and doing some of the crafty stuff. I like doing a lot of the kind of stuff with my hands, like build stuff or create little stuff. So I think that's one thing I think is kind of cool about fishing, especially stuff like that or fly fishing where people kind of create their own little fly ties and stuff. So I've thought about trying to get into that. There's a big community around here for doing that, which has been pretty neat.
KR4, BJL, KB0, KBJ. Yeah, I tried to do it down there once. I can say I've done it. I wasn't very successful. I didn't get anything, but I tried it. But we don't have those kind of rivers and lakes. Well, we don't have those kind of creeks or rivers around here, so it's just lake fishing, essentially. And, yeah, that's how it goes. I myself, I kind of like to do that spear fishing, which is scuba diving out on the Missouri River, and do a little spear fishing. Don't do it too often, but I do enjoy that type of fishing. It's actually more like hunting than fishing. So that's kind of my preferred method, at least at the moment, at this stage in life. Although, you get me, you know, as long as I catch fish, I don't care really how it's done. But that is a fun way to do it right now. I have gone fishing and, like, brook trout fishing in little ponds and such. And Michigan, you walk down and there are beaver ponds and stillaries, you throw a line in there and wham, they'll hit if they're there. If they're not, you just move on. So that's kind of fun. You're tromping through the woods, you know, swatting mosquitoes and horseflies. Hopefully not, but that is the case sometimes while trying to fish. But that can be fun too, as you're I guess what I don't really care for is just sitting in a boat and not doing catching much. Just sitting there. It doesn't take me long to get tired of that. I'm an impatient fella. Back to you.
It seems like going spear fishing would be pretty fun as well. Most of my time, if I was going hunting or fishing, growing up I used to go bird or dove hunting a lot with my dad in different sunflower fields. And I remember sitting up there, and it seems like the birds would always wait until you looked away for just 2 seconds or something like that, and all of a sudden there would just be like 20 birds that would fly overhead. We would take our pipes, tobacco pipes and stuff, and find some, there's an herb nearby called rabbit tobacco, so it always seemed to kind of line up, and right when you're put your gun down for a moment to pack a pipe with some rabbit tobacco, it seems like that's right about the moment that big old flock of dove would come flying by. I spent a lot more time just sitting out there trying to pack that thing than I did. I didn't actually catch much, but it was nice getting to be out there and be in the field.
Yeah, that's exactly how it goes. Turn away and they'll just show up, you know, or get your hands full doing something else. Just like yesterday, I was out there with my spear gun near the shore, and there was water swirling and rippling around, and I took a shot. Missed, I didn't get nothing. I can't see nothing. I'm just kind of shooting at swirling water, you know. I take a shot into this swirling water, but nothing. And now I got to retrieve my spear, pull it in, load it back on the gun, wind up the cord. That, you know, it's held down there with a cord. It's not just winging off. Otherwise, how are you going to get it back if you're underwater? So you wind that up, and then you got it's a big rubber band, essentially, that powers the thing. Half-inch thick rubber band. You got to yard like crazy to get the thing cocked, you know, back and notched back on there. It's got a wire that hooks into the notches on the spear. Pull that thing back, and, you know, while I'm, you know, as soon as I shoot, and I start pulling the spear, putting it in my gun, I look up, and I haven't got the thing all together yet for another shot. There's a fin just going by above the water, you know. I mean, the fish might as well have just stood on its tail and smiled at me, because it's all, I might have thrown a rock at it, or thrown my gun at it, you know. But, yeah, just fin goes by there right above the water. Like, yeah, so I know what you mean.
It'd be pretty hard to, it would be kind of awkward to load that spear gun underwater, unless you were able to anchor yourself against something, but it kind of feels like you would, as you're trying to pull that thing back, it would be hard to get it loaded. I guess unless you're, like you said, I think you reel it in, is there some kind of crank or motor to it? How do you load a spear gun?
Well, let's see. It's let's say about a 22-foot, 30-inch long metal shaft is what your spear is. You know, with a flopping barb on the end. Once it goes through a fish, and if you try to pull it back, the barb will, you know, it's a little flapper there. So that's what keeps the fish on the shaft, on the spear, which has on my gun has a couple notches. Sometimes they have little like shark fins, but whatever. Got some anchoring point. And then you load that back. It's got a notch. It locks in the back of the gun. It sits on top of the gun. And then you got a string. Like I said, half inch thick rubber band. And you have varying lengths of gun. The longer the gun, the more power it has to pull this rubber band back, you know. It's got a metal loop on the end. It is into, yeah, the struggle. You put the butt of the gun against your chest, and you pull the rubber band back with both hands, one on each and you hook the loop, the metal loop, into the notch on the top of the spear. Then you wind the retrieval cable up. Despite all the power this thing has, which it would go through a person easily. Despite all that power, it doesn't go very far in water. Water really, really slows it down. I mean, we're talking 15, 20 feet, you know. So, and I mean, you can't see much further than that typically underwater anyhow, unless you're in the ocean or something. But around here, it's not that great visibility, so what you can't see, you can't shoot, right? So that's pretty much how it works there, over. I'm really quite a one of a small elite bunch that do it. It's a pretty niche way of fishing, I would say. Really, in fact, first of all, you need underwater scuba gear to do it. You know, I guess you could do it from the surface, but you know, most guys who do it are scuba divers. So, how did I get into it? Well, it's really one of the only things to do underwater around here. And there's only a few places to do it, one of them being the Missouri River, where the water's clear enough where you can see fish. Otherwise, it's muddy. The lakes are kind of muddy and cloudy around here with all the soil runoff from farming, you know, big-time farming country. That's what happens. So all that soil runoff in shallow lakes, 10 feet deep, you know, the wind, soil runoff into the lakes, and the wind stirs up the water, and they're just cloudy messes. You can't see your hand in front of your face, literally. So if you get any clear water, which is kind of hard to find, that's about the only thing left to do in the water, you know. It's not like down there in the ocean or the Caribbean where you can see fish and take pictures. You got clear water and there's sharks and little tropical fish, or even off South Carolina. I've been off the coast there. You can go dive shipwrecks there and see fish, and just, you know, it's more pleasure diving down there. So it's just kind of a niche diving thing, I guess, but it's really one of the only things available to make it worthwhile to go underwater around here. So I guess that's how I got into it. I first got into scuba diving when I was down there in South Carolina. And I moved up here. I'm like, what's the purpose of scuba diving? Then I found this. So, over.
Especially with the different types of water. Yeah, most of the people I think that are doing underwater diving, my brother's into that as well. On the coast, you're certainly doing, I think, a lot more. I think you use the term pleasure diving or just kind of visual exploration. So it makes sense that anyone that's got the gear that's near the lakes up there are probably doing it for more hunting purposes or something like that. That does make sense. I don't know. I don't know how I would. I think I enjoy. I consider myself to be fairly adventurous, but I think I enjoy myself being above the water just fine. I think that I like being able to see if I'm in the water. I like to be able to see it pretty clear if I can. If I can't see it, I don't. That's one of those, I think, childhood things that just never quite moved through. I like being able to see the water around me. But, I mean, certainly around the lakes that you're talking about, I doubt that there's anything really that's too big to really be concerned about predatorily. Probably the most dangerous thing in the water with you is probably that spear gun, which is, like you said, under the water gets slowed down quite a bit.
Yeah, you're exactly right there. I mean, that is the most dangerous thing in the water around here is the spear gun itself. You know, when I go, we go with a bunch of guys, and, you know, in diving, in the diving world, it's always impressed and taught that you want to dive with a buddy. Gotta dive with a buddy. And that's mostly to do with the fact of running out of air. Your buddy's supposed to be there and share his air with you, you know. Well, when you go spearfishing, it's not that way. You're like, we dive alone. And so you're carrying a flag, which floats on the surface, trailing behind you. And the water is only 25 feet deep, so it's not deep. I mean, if you have to, just come up, you know. If you run out of air, just swim to the surface. But you're not that... I mean... Anybody ought to have that figured out. You need enough air, you know. But at 25 feet of water, it's not a... If you're dumb enough to have run out of air for some reason, or I guess maybe you could have equipment malfunction, you just go up to the top, you know. It's not going to kill you to come up from 25 feet without having air. So you dive alone because that's the safest way to do it. Instead of shooting each other underwater, you know, in cloudy conditions, 10-15 foot visibility. And how do we stay separated? Well, you got the boat on top, you know, and they're watching the flags. You see two flags start getting too close to each other because we can't see each other. They'll drive over the area and give us the signal to come up, you know. Which is with the boat motor. They'll rev it up a few times to let you know, hey, guys, come on up, you know. You come up and you're like, oh, hey, I was getting too close to you. Okay. So you separate, but, yeah, that is the most dangerous part of being underwater there. Up here is the spear gun itself. But yeah, down there in this coast, I've had two of the best dives I've ever experienced was off the coast of Carolinas. South Carolina, I guess. Myrtle Beach. And what made them so good was the clarity of the water. Absolutely unbelievable. You know, I mean, we're talking 150-foot visibility, you know. You can sit there in 130 feet of water and see the bottom from the top. See people swimming down there. So clear that, this was the first ocean dive I ever did, so clear that you felt like you might fall, you know, you're 100 foot above them, and you're just kind of flying up there. So that was kind of cool. And that was my first ocean dive. So the last time I was down that way also was a really clear visibility. Seen an absolutely monstrous stingray. It was 10 foot across. 20-foot long tail, you know. I had a guy I dove with. He was out of Vermont. He had a break here. He ended up taking a video. Yeah, the guy I got partnered up with there was out of Vermont, and he took a video and put it online. So... on the YouTube there, so I can go look at that and show other folks if I want to that dive, and me getting pretty close to that big stingray. That was kind of cool. But you know, I was on Pelham Road there off of 85, Pelham Road exit. You got Bermuda Triangle Dive Shop. I wouldn't say it's the only one in the upstate, but I know it's one of the only ones. There's not many in the upstate. I think they got some up there near you in Hendersonville, but it may be the only one in the upstate. But anyhow, I know it's there. I was went in there one time, and a fellow who used to own it, run it, I don't know, he's still somewhat involved with it. His name was Reese. I think he's kind of retired out of it mostly, but anyhow, he was running it at the time, and I was about having my tanks filled, were there, and I went and looked in the back room, and or maybe we got to talking about, or no, I think I just seen it, a full table, folding table was full of teeth. I said, what's this? What's this back here, Reese? He's like, oh, those are megalodon teeth. I said, where did you get these? He's like, oh, off the coast. You just find them down in the sand, brush them up. I'm like, cool. Just go swoop scuba diving and find megalodon teeth in the sand. He's like, yeah, yeah. I'm like, oh, okay. So, yeah, some of these look pretty good size. I mean, I have no idea about shark teeth in general. He's like, yeah, you see that one there? And he points to one that's about an inch and a half length from top to bottom. Inch and a half. I was like, yeah. He's like, that's about as big as great white get. I'm like, oh, really? Oh, what's this 5-inch long thing that's the size of my hand? What? How big was that shark, you know? That's pretty cool seeing them over. That's a good one. Yeah, so you know exactly what I mean. It's wild. Wild to experience water that clear. And it does make you feel like you're high in the air when, you know, it's so clear. It's just crazy. Which brings to mind, you know, these guys, there's guys who make their livelihood is saturation diving. No, what I do is recreational diving. You know, 130 foot is about max what they suggest recreational divers go, which isn't too bad. As you can see, most everything you need to. But then you got technical divers. They like to go deeper for whatever reason. I guess if there's something deeper, they can go down. They're more technical, got more gear, more understanding of how your body reacts to pressure and time underwater and buildup of nitrogen and so they start breathing tri-mixes of gas, you know, helium thrown in, and it gets a lot more, you got to know what you're doing. as far as what to breathe and how long to stay under and how fast to come up and all that to just keep yourself safe. And then you got the saturation divers. Now these guys, I guess I hadn't even really thought of it, you know, but these are guys who work on the oil equipment in the North Atlantic. There's lots of oil wells and oil equipment laying on the seafloor in the North Atlantic, from a lot of Europe and England anyhow. That's where you get their oil. And so they're down there in this particular episode I was watching. They were replacing a valve in like 800 feet of water. And what they have to go through to do that, you know, and it's dark. And they'll go for 28 days at a time. And that in that 28 days, they don't go home. Their house burns down. People die. It doesn't matter. They're not getting off the job because they can't. Their body and the pressures they're under all the time for 28 days, they can't leave that environment. And so the only time they get outside of an enclosed environment, see what happens is they get on a ship. It's all made for their diving. The whole ship is made for diving, and it supports that. They get basically put inside of a steel container. They get pressurized, and they get kept under pressure at the working depth that they're going to be working at till the 28 days are up. It takes them like a week to depressurize. So the only time they really get outside of an enclosed environment is down 800 feet in the water, and it's dark and cold. And so when they get down in the Arabian or someplace in the, I think it was Arabian or somewhere down that area of the world, where the water is clear, they're like, this is awesome. It's warm. It's clear. I can see. There's light coming down that 300, 400, 500 feet down. I can see what I'm doing. You know, it's nice versus working in cold, dark in North Atlantic. So, yeah, the clear water even affects their jobs. Back to you there, over.
To think about being down there for that long, for 28 days, you can see why they've made so many movies based on that. I'm trying to remember, there was one. It was an old alien movie from, I think, maybe early 90s or late 80s. There's a golden sphere. I think that one of those crews, I think it was even in the North Atlantic, that they were down there for weeks, and it was kind of based off of the movie Alien. Obviously, that one was in space, but they found some mysterious golden sphere that kind of makes people lose their minds and stuff, but it was actually kind of somewhere they weren't able to come up, despite the fact that they had found this artifact. I needed to, like, report it to people, but then when weird stuff started happening, they still couldn't get up, so that was one of the main problems of the movie, was the inability to escape quickly enough, because they would get sick. I think there was one of the guys even started having like hallucinations and stuff that were similar to like 20,000 leagues under the sea, and everything started getting a lot of tentacles and stuff involved. It kind of got pretty odd, but it was a good movie. I wish I could remember the name of it, but I think it was in the 90s. Maybe it was just shot to be like an older movie, but that was a pretty good one. You mentioned earlier that sometimes people will add different gases. I think you said based off of the depth that people are going down to, like helium. I think that's interesting. I was curious more about that. Why would someone add a gas like helium? I guess it seems like that would increase the amount of pressure inside their chest, which I would, I'm guessing that you're just trying to counteract that pressure. But seems like if you did that for a long time, surely there would be side effects of having a large dose of helium in your system for 28 days. Imagine that would make you start feeling kind of funny. Over.
AR4BJ, LKB0, KBJ. Yeah, well, let's see. I'm not so current on this, and I don't know that much, but I'll tell you what I do know. So the air we breathe is 78% nitrogen, like we're breathing right now, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and 1%, does that work out? Anyhow, it's like 1% all other gases is how they figure it. So you got a lot of nitrogen in the air. And, not so much oxygen. But when you get down at depths, all this air compresses. Say you're at 100 foot, you're breathing in air that is 4 times denser at 100 foot than it is on surface. And, because, you know, you got to have the air pushing out against the water to counteract the water's pressure, right? So you're breathing in 4 times more dense air. Every 33 feet is another atmosphere worth. Every 33 feet of water. So, that's what it works out to. But then, you know, you get so much nitrogen in your, I mean, you don't use the oxygen. I mean, you know, you only use like 7% of the 21% oxygen in the air when you take a breath. So you're actually expelling a lot of oxygen. Still, so only 7% of it do you turn into carbon dioxide, you know. But you still got these loads of nitrogen. Well, nitrogen will build up in your bloodstream. And at them depths for a while, still accumulating in your blood. And then when you come up, if you don't give it time to release and you breathe it off out of your lungs, and this is what everyone knows about is the bends, you know, you'll turn into gas in your blood. And that's not good to have gas bubbles, air bubbles, nitrogen bubbles floating around inside your blood vessels. They block the system, you know, you get you know, blockage to the brain, blockage to this or that, whatever. Brain would be a bad one. Have and block blood flow to the brain, right? So, you gotta take your time and come up slow and, well, it's a hassle working with this nitrogen. So then to replace nitrogen, you could add more oxygen, and I do when I go diving. Makes you a little perkier, you come out of the water a little better feeling. Yeah, I jump it up to like 32% when I go instead of 21% air. Yeah, or 21% oxygen, I jump it up to 32. But then you can add too much oxygen also, and then you get like too nervous. It affects your nerves, and you're starting to wig out and twig out, you know? So you can't have too much. Now, you don't want nitrogen, you don't want oxygen, so you throw an inert gas like helium in the mix, which doesn't have any effect on you other than your voice sounds weird. So that's the purpose of helium. But I guess it does eventually in saturation diving. You do kind of run low on iron after a while. For some reason it takes iron out of you and you feel kind of, I guess you can come back, you got a headache for a few days, you're a little weak. So that's what I know about it, over.
That's interesting. That makes sense, what you're saying. Just adds an inert gas that almost acts as like a place filler to be able to maintain pressure without causing either the oxygen toxicity or the bends that you're talking about there with nitrogen. So that makes sense to use helium there. That's pretty neat. See all that work. I have a friend who was in the military, and he was working on, I think, some of stuff what you were talking about, but doing some of the deep sea, like walking, the weighted stuff. I don't know what the term for that would be, but where people are walking on like the ocean floor, working on docks and stuff, kind of I guess underwater engineer. I think that's what he called it. It was like an underwater engineer. go under for a long period of time. It's not, certainly not as deep. But, yeah, he did that for a little while. I think they were doing underwater welding and stuff. I don't know how in the world you could possibly weld underwater. I guess you'd have to make a chamber or something around it that would be able to react. But he did that for a little while and then went on to go into the Navy as a nuclear engineer. But that seems to be I remember talking about some of those things. It was pretty interesting. Get to do that kind of stuff. I think that would be fun to kind of do your typical routine. That, you know, I've done a little bit of welding above ground, but it seems like it would be kind of cool to have a project like that, to go, like you were saying about the oil miners and stuff. Taking the chance to get to try to solve a problem, work on something, just doing it underwater. That'd be kind of fun.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose that's a fancy term, underwater engineer, but yeah, I've heard about that welding, and I've heard of guys like welding inside of pipes underwater. I think that was the job. I don't know exactly if that was, but the life expectancy of such guys is like, you know, 18 months average life expectancy of doing that job. And I knew a fellow who knew a fellow that did that, and he did it for 18 months and he quit. He said, okay, I'm going on to do something else. And what, you make ridiculous amounts of money, huge amounts of money doing this, because it's such a skilled, technical, dangerous line of work. So he worked his average life expectancy, made it, and he said, moving on. You know, I made my money and I've reached my limits, so we're moving on. But I suppose if you're working inside of pipes, you know, it could be under pressure, and never mind being underwater. And if you're welding, I don't know if there's electricity. I don't know squat about welding underwater. Let's see. I'm assuming there's electricity. You could get electrified, kill yourself through that. who knows, different ways to die underwater. I mean, being underwater is one of, obviously, you know, but enhances every other aspect so much more, the danger aspect. So I guess they make pretty good money doing that, from what I've been told. But yeah, well, I think I'll let you go, Russell, and go find me some ice cream. I think it would be good to have some of that right about now there. Over.
I've appreciated the QSO as well, Steve. You enjoy the rest of your evening. I'm going to kind of wrap up some stuff that I'm working on here. But it's been good talking with you again. This is, again, KB0KBJ. This was KR4BJL, Russell in Hendersonville. I appreciate you. So, 73 to you.
Well, yeah, it's been my pleasure. And hopefully we'll get to run into you again soon. Who knows? Who knows what we might, how we might run into each other on the air. Satellite contact or something, huh? There's so many different rabbit trails and ways you can communicate in this hobby. But this is probably the most likely way. Anyhow, take care there, Russell. Have yourself a great evening also. We'll be clearing out. KR4BJL, KB0KBJ, I'll be clear. 73. Yeah, really. I know they got the capabilities, but I don't know much about it. All right, 73, good night. KB0, KBJ, I'm clear.